You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is November 11th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So happy Veterans Day, everyone.
Yeah, Veterans Day in the United States.
Yep. And to November all 11th. U.S. veterans, thank you for your service and your sacrifice. We do genuinely appreciate it.
A lot of you are SGU listeners. We very much appreciate that.
Yeah. I love getting email. We get lots of email from forward deployed military, too.
That's right. They sometimes will write us and say, I can't disclose exactly where I am right now, but just to let you know, I am listening.
I'm in a submarine under the Sea of Japan right now. I'm like, that's cool.
I remember that one of them said that he came when the submarine would go up and they would get internet. He would download all of our shows. So
and the captain would yell at him, who's hogging up the bandwidth? Almost done, sir.
So last week we just mentioned that the U.S. election had occurred, but we didn't know the results. And today we do. So even though it isn't official yet.
Even though one of the candidates disagrees.
One of the candidates is denying reality. Yeah, so Joe Biden won the U.S. presidential election. He will be sworn in on January 20th, despite whatever shenanigans happen between now and then. I don't think there's the potential for anything to change that fact. But, you know, like we say, Trump is going to go down swinging.
Yeah.
And there is legitimate concern about how the delay in the transition, the cooperation with the transition might affect efforts to fight the pandemic, because also what's happening is the U.S. is breaking records, over 140,000 new cases today of COVID. So still, you know, raging on. But there has been some good news. I'm sure you guys have heard about this.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Pfizer
and a German company. It's Bio Capital N Tech. So I don't know if it's supposed to be BioNTech or BioNTech.
Or is it BioNTech?
BioNTech.
Yeah, because I've seen another company that did the BioN, and it was Beyond, like Beyond Vax, I think was the company.
Okay, BioNTech, whatever.
And
Pfizer, which is an American company. In collaboration, they created a vaccine. It's actually the first, if it gets approved, it would be the first approved mRNA vaccine. I'll tell you about that in a second.
Uh-huh.
And they're in phase three trials. They haven't completed their phase three trials, but they announced preliminary results from these phase three trials. They have looked at data from about 44,000 volunteers who were enrolled. Half the volunteers get the vaccine, the other half get placebo, and then they follow them to see how many in each group get COVID. You know, so they're not deliberately exposing them to COVID or anything. They're just out in the wild how many people get COVID. And you need huge numbers to do that because you're just waiting for people to get exposed.
So statistical.
And so they said they were waiting for a certain number of people to catch COVID totally. And the number hit, well, they were going to stop at 64, but by the time they figured all that out, 94 people had it. So in the trial. So 94 people have it. And of those 94 people who have it, when you compare the two groups, the vaccine appears to have reduced the number of people getting COVID by 90%. So by the usual way that we measure these things, you could say that the vaccine is 90% effective. So this is, that's great. They were hoping to get at least 50% effective, so 90s more, right? So this would be great. 90% effective vaccine is awesome.
And that's a two-dose vaccine, right?
It's a two-dose vaccine, so you have two doses 28 days apart. That's a little bit of a downside.
Yeah.
How do we coordinate that to make sure that people land on that 28 days?
When you get your first one, they schedule you to come in for the second one. You know, 28 days later.
Like that movie.
Yeah, I guess that was a stupid question. But yeah. I'm just worried that, you know, I'm the kind of person that would forget, you know.
Well, that's always a worry.
Oh, my gosh. This, you don't want to forget, Jay.
A lot of people
why it's more ideal to have a single dose vaccine. But, you know, we're going to take what we can get now.
Jay, I have an easy solution for you. You have a Sharpie handy. Okay. When you get it, you write on the back of your hand what the date is 28 days later. Well, you cannot
forget.
It'll
still be there. Yeah.
So, Steve, did you hear that it has to be super cold?
Yes. Minus 80 degrees Celsius.
Wait, for storage or when they inject it into your arm?
No, for storage and shipment. Storage and shipment.
That sounds horrible. Like,
and then you can refrigerate it for up to 3 days, right?
Okay,
so like
okay.
in the physician's office or in the hospital, it could be just regularly refrigerated, but only good for about 3 days. Hmm. But when it's being shipped around the world or whatever, it's got to be stored at negative 80 degrees. So that's a little bit of an inconvenience.
Not ideal.
As well. So let me just go into the data a little bit more. So in the United States, the FDA has made the decision that they're not going to give emergency use authorization to any vaccine unless it has at least 2 months of follow-up for at least half of the people enrolled. That was what they negotiated with the FDA. So that's not going to happen until the end of this month.
Right.
So by the end of November, the FDA could grant an emergency use authorization or an EUA to this vaccine, which means that we can start using it. Like really, there'll be no limit at that point on its use. It won't have full approval. It won't have permanent approval, but it'll have like this EUA, which will be good enough for now.
Do we know what the production would look like at that point?
The Pfizer says they will be able to get about 50 million doses. So that's 25 million people's worth, right? Mm-hmm. By the end of this year. And then another 1.3 billion doses, or around 650 million people with two doses each by the end of 2021.
Well, and the good news is because they're a month apart, it's almost like they can increase the number of people so long as they can have the production capacity keep up with that 28-day delay.
Yeah. You don't have to wait until you have the second dose to give.
Exactly. So they can actually vaccinate more people at the beginning, which would be good.
So that's a lot. So shortly, 600 million people is not a lot for the world. It's less than 10% of the world. But that should cover a lot of the U.S. and Europe, which I think is who's going to be getting this vaccine, because it's a German and an American company.
Well, and also I think the freezing component is going to preclude certain developing nations from having access this early anyway.
And so there's already discussion about how to prioritize it. There's a Joint Commission on Vaccination and Immunization has issued guidelines, which is probably something like this is probably what's going to happen. So older adults in nursing homes and nursing home workers would be the first people to get it. And then those over 80 and healthcare workers, social care workers, maybe other frontline workers will get it. And then it's basically by medical risk, which is mostly by age at that point. Anyone over 75, then over 70, then over 65, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense. Also, it's not just you want to protect the people who are most at risk of getting it. You also want to protect the people who are most at risk of spreading it. So we want to shut down those nodes of spread, the people who are on the front lines and most likely to pick it up.
I was like, where on that list is like spring breakers?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Or if you were,
are you an irresponsible teenager? Come
or
get
maybe for people who work in the White House. I don't know.
Yeah.
So let's talk about an mRNA vaccine. So this would be the first approved mRNA vaccine. So mRNA stands for messenger RNA. RNA is the genetic material for this type of virus. There are RNA viruses, there are DNA viruses. Obviously, mammals, vertebrates use DNA for their genetic material. But messenger RNA is essentially the RNA that gets transcribed into protein, right? Or at least it carries the message from the DNA to the apparatus that turns it into protein. So the idea is that you inject the mRNA, and it has the carriers and whatever else it needs to get into the cells. And then the host cells will make viral proteins from the mRNA, and those viral proteins will then trigger an immune response. So instead of injecting the proteins, or a virus or a killed virus or whatever, you inject the mRNA, and then the host makes their own protein, their own viral protein, which is what provokes the immune response. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
So not necessarily more effective than other vaccines, but the advantage is that we're really good at making RNA, at this point. So just for production purposes, we should be able to produce this vaccine very quickly, right? So the hope would be like we get an mRNA flu vaccine. This is one of the things we're hoping to do with the flu vaccine, because right now the flu vaccine takes a long time to make, and that's part of the problem is that we're always trying to guess 3 or more months ahead, what the strains are going to be. But if we could shorten the duration from picking a strain to distributing a vaccine, then there's less of a chance that we'll get the wrong strain, right? We'll pick the wrong strain. So that would be pretty cool, a new type of vaccine, not just a vaccine for COVID. And this is with a 90% efficacy, if there's a significant rollout and uptake of this vaccine, this can definitely be a game changer for the pandemic. This could really be the light at the end of the tunnel. Although, again, we're still talking about the end of 2021 before you get massive distribution. But it'll be ramping up the whole time, and it'll be, you know, we'll be seeing the benefits the whole time, not just at the end.
But, well, I was hearing like a lot of distribution happening in April. Is that true? Yeah.
But again, they're saying 1.3 billion doses by the end of 2021. So that's, take that for what it's worth.
How much ramping up are they anticipating? Are they including that in these numbers? I mean, I'm sure there's different levels of ramping up that are possible.
This is what they project they will be able to do with all the ramping up. Yep. Now, of course, this is only one of many vaccines that are in the final stages of production. So the hope is that there'll be a dozen other vaccines coming out sometime next year as well.
And then we'll have better coverage for sure.
Will those vaccines look sort of and function in a similar way to this one, or could they be totally different?
Totally different. Yeah, so there are other mRNA vaccines, but they're not all mRNA vaccines. There's different types of vaccines that are in production.
Yeah, but there is one that's, I think that's nearing the end, that is similar to this Pfizer vaccine. Yeah. They're even more confident now that it's going to work because it's so genetically similar.
Mm-hmm.
So, guys, I'm interested. Have you guys heard about these mink in Denmark?
They're going to call them, right?
They are calling them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So in Denmark, it's been seen that and well documented that mink carry the virus and can pass it on to people. And from what I understand, it's the only animal that we have like very good verification is able to pass the virus on to people. So there's thought that the pangolin was a source, but we still haven't been able to confirm that.
It went from the bat to like a snake, a bat, a pangolin.
But we haven't been able to actually say this is the person who got it from this pangolin. Whereas we have, there are 200 people whose mutated virus tracks back to the mink that carried it. So we know that minks have long been reservoirs for coronaviruses. We also know that mink are capable of transmitting to the virus to humans. So this is a big deal. We also know that there's a specific mutation in the mink farm, specifically these ones that have been found in Denmark. So because of that, it's not necessarily more dangerous. But it may be the case that it's concerning that the mutations that they found have been specifically on the proteins that are involved in vaccination efforts.
Mm-hmm.
So cluster 5, there's a variant called virus cluster 5, which is specifically on the spike protein, and that's what's targeted by a lot of vaccines. There's no proof yet that it would actually have any effect on efficacy of vaccines, but just because in very basic lab studies it raises concern, the government said, yes, we're gonna cull 17 million farmed mink.
Wow.
But also, this is not really unprecedented. Think about all the birds that were culled during bird flu. Think about all the pigs that were culled during swine flu. In a way,
all of the cattle and sheep for hoof and mouth disease in the UK. I mean, they just wiped them out.
And in a way, I think that this is almost an easier decision to make because a lot of people already have a moral. It's one thing to say, okay, cows, birds, pigs, we don't want to catch this disease from our food source, but still people eat animal protein. Mink is farmed for fur.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a much easier decision because there's already a lot of controversy even about the idea of making fur out of farmed mink.
All right. So we'll be definitely paying attention to what happens with this vaccine, especially the rest of the safety monitoring. And hopefully it'll get the green light in a couple of weeks. You know, who knows? Maybe by the end of the year, people will actually be getting vaccinated for COVID. That would be awesome. All right. Let's go to some news items. Jay, this is an interesting item. 3D printing with bacteria, what's that about?
Yeah, I mean, it's not really 3D printing. It's just a fun way to think about it, but researchers...
It's additive manufacturing, is that accurate?
That's the exact same thing.
You know, no, it's not. No. It's not, but let me tell you, because I don't really know. I don't, you know, like, I know how 3D printers work. I have some keywords I can throw at you that I learned, but let's at the end of this, let's quiz everyone and see what they think. So... Researchers at Aalto University in Espoo, Finland have developed a technique where they can use bacteria to create highly detailed three-dimensional designs that are made of nanocellulose. Mm. Bob, did that get you excited?
It did.
The researchers are now able to do something really, really cool. They can direct the growth of the bacterial colonies by using superhydrophobic surfaces. So in case you don't know, a superhydrophobic surface means that the surface repels water and other liquids. They can make them using a lot of different materials. So what they all have in common is they have an incredibly thin layer of air that gets trapped on the surface of whatever the object is. I think it gets trapped because of the texture of the surface of that object, right? So there's a famous leaf out there that's hydrophobic and water. Yeah, the lotus leaf. That's right. And if you touch it, you could feel it. It has a texture to it. There's something about it that isn't perfectly smooth. Well, that's probably why. So they make a super hydrophobic mold, and they put water mixed with sugar, proteins, and air inside the mold, right? So the mold is something that they want that shape to be adopted. So when aerobic bacteria are added to the mix, something cool happens. So aerobic bacteria thrive in an oxygen-rich environment. And when you take them and you mix them with water and sugar and protein, like, they have everything that they need to survive. You know, they eat. And the byproduct is nanocellulose, which basically means it's cellulose that has been connected into nano-sized structures. Now, this kind of nanocellulose is dense and it's fibrous. And as the nanocellulose increases, a biofilm replicates the inside of the mold, right? So you can imagine that right where the hydrophobic area is, which is basically the inside of the mold, that's where the bacteria is eating and doing all of its biological actions. And then it secretes the nanocellulose, and then it starts to get this lattice-like form, and it follows the shape of the inside of the mold. So if they give it more time, the mold will continue to get thicker, and it increases the overall strength of the biofilm. So this is being described as biological 3D printing, right? So this is where, you know, Steve is saying, sure, we can call it biological 3D printing, but it's very, very different than normal 3D printing. The nanocellulose fibers, they have a diameter of 1,000 times thinner than a human hair. The researchers are able to align the fibers in any orientation they want, which I could not find any information on exactly how they're doing that, including crisscrossing layers. So they can make a layer that's going in one direction and then another layer that's going in another direction. Very, very cool stuff. They also can choose the thickness of the biofilm, and they can even somehow make it so it has a gradient of thickness, right? So some areas would be very thick and it would taper off in other areas and be thinner. This is really cool work that they're doing. So Luis Greca, who is a doctoral student at Aalto University, he described it as, it's like having billions of tiny 3D printers that fit inside a bottle. We can think of the bacteria as natural microbots that take the building blocks provided to them and with the right input create complex shapes and structures. So this is the phrase that I like best. The field of study can be called biofabrication. That's really cool. And science fiction, Bob and I have talked about this, like, you know, having living bacteria, whatever, like, make stuff, you know, like, why does it have to be from the ground up? We should go from the top down and have, you know, small biology do things that we program them to do. Well, here's the first example of it that I'm really seeing. So they can vary the thickness from 1/10 of a diameter of a human hair all the way to 20 centimeters. And that's not that thin. And the biofilm does not have any negative reaction when it comes in contact with human tissue, and that's huge. That means that the new objects that they can make are very likely to be used in medicine. Very, very likely. And some scientists are saying that they could assist in tissue regeneration, including muscle and brain tissue. They also think that they could build realistic organs that would be used to train surgeons. So I like it. I think it's really provocative. I like that it's already functioning. You know, who knows if they could scale it up again, but they're building these things. Like, we can see pictures of them. I feel like this could be something that might not be that long before it becomes practical.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's an interesting way to make a very tiny, you know, object. But speculating now about the applications, I think that's always where it gets difficult.
Yeah.
We won't know what the killer app is. And I think any of the things you mentioned probably aren't going to be the killer app, you know, for this technology. But still, it's really cool. I like the idea of using living things like bacteria, like tiny robots, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tiny robots.
This is what they are. All right. You guys know what debunking is, right?
Sure.
Of course. That's like what we do.
I think so.
Yeah, I know.
It's when you get off of your bunk bed.
Yeah, and you remove the top bunk from the lower bunk.
Oh, you guys think so.
Have you heard of pre-bunking?
Only because you wrote about it.
Yeah. So pre-bunking is the idea that rather than trying to disabuse somebody of a false belief that they have, is that you give them the skills to be resistant to the false idea in the first place. So this is obviously
like doing that since
96.
Yeah, this is something that we do, and we've talked about this quite a bit, the idea that you have to prepare people with critical thinking skills. And you know, the evolution of, I think, our conceptualization of what works, we started with scientific literacy, you know, the knowledge deficit approach. Mm-hmm. Then we said, nope, that's not enough. You need scientific literacy and you need critical thinking skills. And now I would say you also need media literacy, right? You kind of need all three.
Right.
A group of researchers have come out with a game and also a research project. The name of the game is Harmony Square. And it's basically, the idea is to give people, it's mainly media literacy. You could argue it's some critical thinking skills in there as well, but to me, it's mainly media literacy. So the idea of the game is that, and I've played it, I don't know if any of you guys have had a chance to play it.
Mm-mm, I haven't.
That the person playing the game, it's a free online web-based game. The person playing the game has the opportunity to try to disrupt this quiet town, Harmony Square, that's heavily engaged in the democratic process by using the different mechanisms of trolling, essentially. So they say, or of producing misinformation, which they outline as polarization, invoking emotions, spreading conspiracy theories, trolling people online, deflecting blame, and impersonating fake accounts. So you could do all of these things in order to have this misinformation effect on the people of Harmony Square. It's actually not that much of a game, to be honest with you. They kind of just walk you through. You're making these A-B choices all the way through, but I don't know that it really affects much. It's not a game, in my opinion, like Plague Inc. is a game, you know, where you're actually determining the outcome and there's some skill to it. Like people have to really, I think if they were more engaged strategically with what's happening, it might be more effective. But in any case, the idea, so the question was, does this actually help people recognize and be resistant to the same misinformation techniques being used against them? And so they did also publish a study with the 15,000 participants in a pre- and post-game design. And they did find that there was a statistically significant decrease in people's acceptance of misinformation after playing the game. So they're saying that there's some beneficial effect to the pre-bunking approach. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, you know, I think I'll accept that as far as it goes, although I think there's some significant caveats to this. First, to the study itself, I'm familiar with a lot of research that also shows that whenever you do absolutely anything to engage people's question about whether or not something is true, they tend to be more skeptical about it, right? So it's just the fact that you're reminding people that they are supposed to think about whether or not something is true, right? So if you say, what I'm about to tell you is true, or if somebody says, this is not true, or this is questionable, whatever, if you make any statement that refers to the truth status of what people are then exposed to, it reduces their acceptance of it. They get more skeptical about it. So that's kind of a non-specific effect. And it's possible that that's what we're seeing here, the sort of non-specific effect of, well, anytime you engage people in any way that makes them think about whether or not something is true, they're going to question whether or not it's true. But, you know, but there still could be a more specific effect in here as well. I just think we need more research to tease that out. But the main concern that I have is I don't think this study tells us how this would play out in the real world.
Psychology studies rarely do.
Yeah, I know.
Unfortunately.
Right? That's sort of a generic problem with psychology studies because they're contrived in order to get your data. But think about it. So do we really want to teach people how to be better trolls in order to protect them from being trolled?
Yeah.
It doesn't take much of a leap to think that that might have unintended negative consequences and that the net effect of that may not be positive in the real world. Also, I'm just going to play off of my experience in the skeptical movement. You guys can tell me what you think about this. So, you know, one of the things that we have spoken about and even wrote about and talk about is the fact that when people first start to learn critical thinking concepts, that their first instinct is to use it as a weapon against other people,
mm-hmm.
rather than to use it the way it should be used, which is to police their own thinking and to make them more critically thinking and more skeptical. And sure, it may convey some resistance to being conned or being fooled or, you know, to mechanisms of deception. But honestly, like we know, like with the logical fallacies, the first thing people do when they learn about the logical fallacies is use them to attack the arguments of other people, whether that legitimately or illegitimately. So I could certainly see the same thing happening here. Like, oh, that's how you sow chaos in an online conversation. Okay, this is like giving me new skills that I can use to troll other people better.
But that also kind of implies, I suppose, and that's a bigger social question, whether that is the rationale or justification for individual engagement in media or online. So are these individuals predisposed to want to sow chaos, or are these individuals interested in a harmonious interaction?
I think that there's a subset of people, you know, 2-3% or whatever, who are just psychologically dedicated trolls. And again, there's some preliminary psychological research to show us that basically trolls are psychopaths. And that they're going to do that no matter what.
You know, I've been watching documentaries about like Russian disinformation campaigns and things like that. I still think there's a concerted, intentional effort that exists online that accounts for a decent percentage of trolling. That's not a function of individual actors who have a purpose that's, you know, a personal drive.
Yeah, absolutely. So that is yet another category that mm-hmm. you're talking about, which is not organic behavior on social media. Those are deliberate campaigns.
Right. And if we can recognize that and be armed with the information, then perhaps it might actually lead to resistance against it.
And I don't know. Depending on how you look at it, like I know there have been studies which are like half of all accounts on Twitter are bots, you know, before they have to purge them. But of course, they're going to come back at some point. But there's this third category, which is where I think most people are. So now we're not talking about bots or, you know, whatever Russians somewhere, you know, with a dedicated disinformation campaign and not the psychopath who's just out there to make trouble. But we're talking about most people who are just on social media. I think their trolling behavior is very context dependent.
Absolutely.
And I think that everyone can be a troll at some points in time.
Mm-hmm.
Most skeptics, like if they went onto an anti-vaccine social media platform, whether it's like a Facebook page or whatever,
Reddit,
they would be the troll. Whether they would be certainly perceived as the troll, whether it was fair or not, but it would also be very easy to fall into trolling-like behavior because you think you are right. And these people are crazy. And so,
yeah, regardless of whether you are right. Yeah.
You might think you're on a crusade, but
when you're on your home turf, then other people are the troll. When you're going onto other people's, you know, social media home turf, then you become the troll. So I think, and I'm not saying that everybody does that, but I bet you a lot of people at some point in time do things which are like, yeah, you know, that probably falls into one of these categories.
But Steve, to be fair, and this is my anecdotal experience, you know, I made it my mission to be as even keeled as I possibly could on Facebook, especially when I'm in other people's spaces on Facebook. And regardless of what my behavior was, I was treated like I was a hard hitting troll.
Mm-hmm.
Just because,
but that's
the
point too, right? That it can be self, kind of not self. It can be externally.
It's partly subjective.
Driven.
Yeah, it's partly confirmation bias. Yeah, like, you know, we talked about sea lioning, right?
You know, just God, I hate
endlessly,
sea liners.
I know. I have somebody doing that on one of my blog posts now. It's just endless. But
Where's the proof? I'm being kind to you. All I want is evidence.
Yeah, right. But, you know, you could totally see skeptics falling into that role, whether they're honest or not. Just like if you're talking with somebody who's making a claim, like, and you're just saying, well, I don't, you know, show me the evidence to support that claim. And, you know, you could take it to the point where somebody else might perceive it as sea lioning when you're just sincerely trying to demonstrate their lack of evidence. So anyway, it's just it can be very subjective. And I do think that, you know, it does help for people to be media savvy so they can monitor their own behavior, be fair you know, the principle of charity, again, is probably the single most important thing in online, any interactions, but especially online. Be fair in assessing other people's behavior and try to use this to sort of raise the level of interaction rather than use it as a weapon.
You're talking about the pre-bunking.
I'm talking about all of it. But yeah, certainly, specifically in this case, the media literacy skills that they're trying to teach with this game. It cuts both ways, right? Just like critical thinking skills cut both ways. At the end of the day, I do think, as Jay said, you have to want to be the good guy, right? You have to want to be legitimate, to be valid in your approach, like to only believe things that are actually true. You have to like really be humble and you have to really be conscientious about the principle of charity. And if you're not, nothing else matters, right? All the media literacy and critical thinking skills and scientific literacy in the world doesn't matter because they can all be twisted to serve whatever motivated reasoning you want.
Oh, and yeah.
We see this all the time as well, you know?
So I came across this really interesting piece in Nature that I think is sort of ancillarily related to what you were just talking about. And I don't know if she specifically cites your study, but what she does talk about is this idea of counting conspiracy theories. And she references the word pre-bunking, which makes me think that this is sort of like, in addition, this is my take. So it's this political psychologist, and she writes about something that I think of as almost fundamental, but also a little bit more forest than trees, which is that if we're going to counter conspiratorial thinking in the general public, we have to think about the well-being of individuals as a whole, that one of the core components or one of the core kind of, let's say, predictors of conspiratorial belief are defensiveness, deflection, powerlessness, anxiety, isolation, alienation, that there are these kind of psychological constructs that people who tend to be attracted to conspiracy theories often have, and marginalization and powerlessness, or at least perceived grievances, like powerlessness and marginalization are big ones. And so as a culture and society, if individuals are less likely to feel that way, they may be less likely to glom on. So in healthier cultures where we have, let's say, more education for women, where we have less income inequality, where we have access to healthcare and things like that, and definitely access to mental healthcare, we may actually see less conspiratorial movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really interesting idea, probably one that's pretty well supported by evidence, but that we often just don't bring into the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a very complicated area.
Of course.
But it's right at the core of what we do. So I think we need to become experts in this. You know, so I think just reading as much of this as possible is going to be really, really helpful.
Steve, getting back to the game, though, itself for a second, you mentioned that about 3% of our trolls, that's... But you're also saying that perhaps if people were exposed to this game, that might bring out an inner troll in them that had otherwise not already surfaced?
No, that's not really what I'm saying. I'm just saying that we all can be trolls in the right context and giving people the skills. Because you can't teach people to recognize trolling without giving them the skills to be a troll. Just like you can't teach somebody how to recognize a con without inadvertently teaching them how to be a con artist.
It's like a white hat hacker, right?
Yeah, it's like a white hat hacker.
Yeah.
To
be able to do it.
So let's teach people how to hack so that they could be white hat hackers. Well, hey, maybe some of them might not be white hat hackers at the end.
Yeah,
that's a good, it's a really good analogy. But I think that at the end of the day, we want people to have these skills, these media literacy skills. What I eventually arrived at is that you need to have that in addition to a genuine desire, you know, to have good social behavior and to be, you know, critical thinker and to only believe things that are absolutely true. Because like we know that, for example, global warming deniers, they don't have any problem with scientific literacy. In fact, some of them are more scientifically literate than the average person. Statistically, that's not the problem.
Not
so just
enough,
teaching
right?
teaching them more science is not going to make them not deny global warming. Whereas in other contexts, like we see people displaying at least a knowledge of the form and the words of critical thinking skills. They could cite logical fallacies and the preeminence of facts and all this, you know, all this confirmation bias. But they're all using that in service to a false belief, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So how do we prevent that from happening?
Yeah, it's like the engineer, you know, they're brilliant engineers, but somehow they think a perpetual motion machine is possible and they've got a design for one.
Yeah, like they're more sophisticated in their belief in a perpetual motion machine because they're an engineer.
Right.
So there's a certain critical level that you have to get beyond where it actually helps and is not just making you a more sophisticated troll or a more sophisticated pseudoscientist or science denier. And that's a relatively high level in my experience before, you know, the knowledge of critical thinking and science and media literacy actually, you know, reduces your belief in stuff that isn't true. You know, and I think most skeptics are kind of, they come to skepticism already wanting to believe what's true. And then we just give them the skills to do it better, but which is different than trying to make somebody skeptical by giving them these skills, right? Does that make sense? All right, let's move on. Kara, you're going to tell us the real cause of light pollution.
Well, I'm going to tell you what it's not.
Okay.
I wish I could tell you completely. Well,
that's a start.
It's a start, right? So a cool study that was done utilizing satellites, the Suomi National Polar Orbiting Partnership, the NPP satellite, some researchers decided to look at the city of Tucson, Arizona. And the reason they chose Tucson, Arizona is because Tucson has upgraded streetlights, and those upgraded streetlights are adaptive. City officials can adjust their brightness over the course of each night. And so they usually operate somewhere in like at the 60%, I think, capacity. But what they decided to do is over a few cloudless nights, they looked at them, 14,000 of the city's 19,500 streetlights were dimmed to 30% of their maximum brightness over the course of a few nights. They also boosted them to 100% of their maximum brightness over the course of a few cloudless nights. And then they looked at the overall light pollution as understood or as sampled through this NPP satellite. And what they found is that when they did the calculations, right, the difference between 30% brightness and 100% brightness and adjusted for those maximum illuminations and sort of subtracted it against the background and did all their fancy math, they realized the streetlights only accounted for 20% of the city's light pollution.
Wow.
So what, the rest are buildings and other things?
Yeah, so they're saying it could be, they think, illuminated windows in shop fronts, neon lighting, a big one, sports field lighting, car headlights. You know, there are a lot more sources of light than we often think. And I think the reason that this is such an important study, even though it doesn't really fully tell us the whole picture, is that it's one of the first of the kind that looked at the whole picture as best as they could, utilizing the data that we have, and said, hey, a lot of our mitigation right now is only focusing on streetlights. And maybe that's not the bulk of the problem. I mean, it's great to have these you know, downward splashing streetlights. It's great to have these smart streetlights that will adjust darker over the course of the night because people's eyes actually adjust to them. So a cool thing is they realized that nobody complained. Not a single person in the whole city of Tucson raised the issue between the 30% versus the 100% nights. Like, they didn't seem to notice because their eyes just adapt to
it. And there was no increase of accidents or any other sort of negative effects.
Yeah, no outcome that they saw from that. So that's kind of also like a secondary interesting takeaway from the study, although it's not what their, you know, research question was. So it goes to show that although these mitigation efforts are really interesting and important, and yes, I think there's a lot we can do with streetlights, and they don't need to be nearly as bright as they are, and they should be able to be adaptable and all that great stuff. Just changing the streetlights is just not enough to reduce light pollution. We've got to be thinking about other sources.
In recent years, we've talked about this. I've been surprised at how bad light pollution was. You know, it wasn't until like I really tried to get a good view of the nighttime sky in various locations. Like, crap. Like, if you're anywhere near any kind of city, even really modest ones now, you can't see anything. You have to really be out in semi-rural areas, like suburban bordering on rural or rural areas.
Yeah,
to
I mean,
look at the sky. And even then, it's not a dark sky location.
No, you've got to really think about that too. Like, you've got to look at, obviously, the darkness of the sky is the moon there. There are light, you know, celestial objects there. But also, I found that the darkest observing that I've done here in California has been in Joshua Tree National Park, or just outside of the park, if I'm able to find a site where the mountains block anything coming from the city. That's really helpful when you have these.
So we need more mountains, you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. You got to just observe from the other side of a mountain.
Remember when we were in Christchurch last year and we had to drive a good half hour outside of the city
in order to find
a place that was dark enough where we could see that.
And even I didn't go with you, but did you try and observe away from this? You know what I mean? Like keep your back to the city in terms of allowing yourself to adjust, obviously.
No, we had a good view. Yeah, we had to drive out into the boonies for about at least a half an hour to get it. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Kara.
Yep.
All right, Bob. So I understand that physicists are on the brink of solving one of the major paradoxes of physics.
So there's been a break-in. I mean, a breakthrough. Douglas Adams, actually, it's a series of potentially breakthrough papers that some claim resolve one of the most famous paradoxes in physics regarding black holes and information. Do they resolve the paradox? And what is this paradox? I don't think we've discussed it too deeply on this show in quite a while, if ever. So this is about the famous black hole information paradox. It has to do with apparently conflicting evidence whether information is lost forever when it falls into a black hole. You know, can information be lost forever? Or is there some sort of information conservation principle that, generally speaking, quantum mechanics insists that information can never truly be lost? That the present preserves information about the past. So this little crisis arose when Stephen Hawking famously predicted that quantum effects near the surface of a black hole should emit Hawking radiation. Wouldn't you just love a type of radiation named after you? I've thought about this. Bob radiation doesn't sound good enough, though. I'm going to have to think about a cool way to describe that. So anywho, the Hawking radiation is unstructured. It's utterly random. If it came from Jay falling into the black hole, or if it came from just a meatball, they could never in principle be distinguished. Granted, there's a little difference between those two, but still. So that meant that when the black hole evaporated in a Google years, approximately, all that meatball information or J information would be lost. So this caused a little bit of a physicist schism of sorts, I guess you could say. Some believing information was preserved, some following Hawking saying that it didn't. And for 30 years, they've been working on this. And in the past few, researchers have made the most progress on this topic since Hawking made his advances in the 70s. In a sense, what they've done here is extend the semi-classical approach that Hawking took for his big discovery. So in this context, semi-classical means that it's a hybrid. Say it, Jay. It's a hybrid. It's classical-ish. It's a hybrid of quantum mechanics describing the matter around black holes and Einstein's classical theory of gravity. Now, Hawking was praised for this work and insight, but it was thought at that time, I didn't know this, that he had taken his calculations as far as they could go and no more progress would be made using this semi-classical approach until we had a full-fledged theory of quantum gravity, which fuses quantum mechanics and relativity. So this was one of the big surprises of this latest research, that there are additional semi-classical effects that Hawking did not find, apparently. So using cutting-edge techniques involving, for example, looking at the black hole from, say, a mathematical higher dimension, what they found can be described as a hazy image of a geometrical connection between some of the interior of the black hole to the outside. I mean, this is not clearly defined. This is, like I said, it's a hazy kind of first look at this, some sort of connection between the inside of the black hole, parts of the inside, to the outside. And essentially what that is then is a way for the information to get out. This is kind of like what they've glimpsed. In the real world, they believe this would manifest itself as the black hole in the latter part of its long life, increasingly being unable to prevent that formerly hidden information on the inside from coming out encoded in that Hawking radiation. So the black holes that are around today aren't really releasing any of this specific information, but only later in their lives would it become increasingly likely that they would be releasing it, and a lot of it, eventually releasing it as soon as it gets in a sense, towards the end of their lives. But what the new calculations do not show us, though, it's many things. For example, how the information gets out, really no clue. Can you take this information that's coming out of the black hole and can you bring it together and measure it? We have no idea. They've made no progress on that. These are really big and important questions that are a part of this. So just because the information exists in principle, and I remember that, just because, oh yes, this information in principle exists, it doesn't mean that it can be practically decoded and understood, regardless of the technology at your disposal. It's kind of like chaos and nonlinear dynamics and predicting, the future of chaotic systems like the weather, regardless of what your technology is. There's just no way you're going to be able to predict the weather with accuracy, say, 10 days, 2 weeks, 3 weeks in the future. Inherently impossible, because that's the way nature reveals itself to us. It doesn't matter what technology you have. So it's nice to know, I guess, that in principle this information exists, but that doesn't mean we could actually read it and learn about what has gone into that black hole. Mm. An important part of this paradox, though, whether this information is preserved or not, has already pretty much been resolved for years. This isn't like a new thought that these physicists are having. Most physicists already believe that information is conserved. And one reason is the belief that any of the radiation that leaves a black hole should have some sort of quantum entangled connection within the black hole. But how about this? Back in 2004, Hawking himself paid a bet that he made because he became convinced that black hole evaporation does preserve information. Even he was convinced 16 years ago that he was wrong about that. So this is nothing brand new, like, oh my God, we finally did it. Like, no, these latest advances I've been discussing give these beliefs more of a solid mathematical rigor behind them. And of course, they seem to also give this first faintest peek into the inside of a black hole, which is fascinating. So regardless, we will certainly be reading more about this not fully resolved paradox for years to come. But I'll add that I think these semi-classical approximations probably have run their course. To fully describe this phenomenon, we really need quantum gravity. And that was actually a big disappointment for these researchers. They were hoping that their research would shed more light on quantum gravity and really start to give them the hooks into a more of fully developed quantum gravity. And we're still nowhere near that. And we really, truly need it to answer a lot of these big questions of physics. And I just hope I see, the beginnings of this theory, especially before Jay dies, so I could talk to him about it.
You think part of the interest is because of the whole Stephen Hawking role in it, like with the bet and everything?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I mean, he was such a huge figure in physics, and he was so beloved. If he found out that he was wrong about something, he's paid many bets in his life, and it's just like a good skeptic and scientist, go with the evidence, and he certainly did that. But yeah, that's definitely part of the appeal here, Steve, I think.
All right, thanks, Bob. All right, Evan, Bob spoke recently about nuclear thermal engines, but there's a bit of an update you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, and it reminds me, I think the first time that any of us in our lives maybe heard about using nuclear power as a means of space transportation would have been from Carl Sagan's Cosmos, the original series, 1980. That was probably my first exposure.
Yeah, I think it was, yeah.
He talked a little bit about Project Orion, which was a study of a spacecraft, and it was intended to be directly propelled by a series of atomic bomb explosions behind the craft to push it along. And the idea, generally, of using atomic or nuclear energy for propulsion actually has origins back to the 1940s, from what I researched. Just the dawn of the whole era.
So, oh, yeah.
And it was just recently announced that a company called the Ultra Safe Nuclear Corporation — it's a very reassuring name of a corporation, by the way — the Ultra Safe Nuclear Corporation.
That's real. That's sci-fi movie.
USNC.
Yeah, right. Evan, let me throw in that we tested these some nuclear engines. And I think it was in the 60s, and then they were basically canceled to work on the space shuttle.
They have designed a new thermal nuclear engine capable of carrying astronauts to Mars in about 3 months' time. That's great. That's less than half the time it would take using our most powerful chemical-based propulsion systems. USNC has been working on microreactors for terrestrial power. These are mini reactors utilizing high-assay, low-enriched uranium, or HALEU — that's H-A-L-E-U for short. And HALEU is derived from reprocessed civilian nuclear fuel, and it gets enriched to between 5 and 20%. And it's being used by more than 20 companies right now in their designs for microreactors. And some are expected to actually go online within maybe a few years. I read 2026 was a target date to have these online, which would be fantastic. And it said that HALEU allows developers to optimize their systems for longer life cores, increased efficiencies, and better fuel utilization, which is great. So at the same time that this next generation of nuclear power comes online on Earth, so these companies like UltraSafe are also turning their proven designs into the next generation of space engines. Dr. Michael Ades is one of the principal engineers at USNC Tech, and he said the new concept of this engine is more reliable than previous nuclear thermal propulsion designs. The engine can produce twice the specific impulse of a chemical rocket, and specific impulse is a measure of a rocket's efficiency. They have a specific design. It's called a fully ceramic microencapsulated fuel, or an FCM.
No, it's not.
For short. Yeah. Fully ceramic.
Like a turbo encapsulator.
Yeah, a little bit, a little bit. But basically what it is, it's the HALEU fuel encapsulated into particles coated with zirconium carbide. That's an interesting concept. And if I were learned at all in nuclear energy, that would even probably maybe more impressive than it sounds. But apparently this is their particular way of going about making this particular fuel. Dr. Ades claims the fuel is much more rugged than conventional nuclear fuels, which means it can operate at high temperatures, producing a safer reactor design with the high thrust and specific impulse that could previously only be obtained with highly enriched uranium. And I suppose there's this debate about which way to go. Do you use the highly enriched uranium, or do you use these HALEU fuels instead? What's the best way of doing it? And I've read some brief pamphlets and things online sort of saying how NASA, among others, are sort of throwing this back and forth as to which is the best way to go. But this company is going
with HALEU.
I think
it's obvious. I think that HALEU is definitely the way to go. I mean, with it, you get smaller designs, you get longer life cores, you get less waste and increased fuel efficiency. That's exactly what you need for space. Exactly what you need for space. So to me, that's a no-brainer.
And with HALEU, we can make it right now. It can be produced with current supply chains and manufacturing plants. So you don't have to go inventing something entirely new. We can just scale it up to the point where we would have enough of this to be used as part of an engine to get to Mars. And of course, you know, we've talked about travel to Mars and also in the context of what's more important, sort of going to the moon, going to Mars, you know. Well, we can kind of work on both. They each have their own set of obstacles and hurdles to obtain.
But there's a lot of overlap, though.
That's yeah, I don't. Yeah, but we don't really need nuclear thermal propulsion to get to the moon. So we are talking about this more in the context of how to get to Mars. And if you can shorten that trip to Mars, you shorten any astronaut's exposure to the radiation, among other problems that are out there. But shortening the trip is a huge, huge hurdle. And that's what this is all about.
I wonder, because I talked not too long ago about how DARPA is working on nuclear thermal propulsion, but not for Mars. They want to use it to kind of compete in the space that's between the Earth and the Moon, because that's like the next important area that that some nations will be trying to dominate and control. And with the nuclear thermal engines that they're talking about, they're not really meant to go to Mars. They're meant to actually to move assets like satellites very quickly within this space, you know, that's between the Earth and the Moon. And then that design, when I talked about that topic, I was saying how that design would be like the homework you would need to create a little bit more powerful ship that could then go to Mars. So I wonder if this is like some duplication of effort, or if there's some kind of, like, you know, work between these two. Are these companies, were they working together? But it's interesting. So whatever it is, I'm happy, because the more companies and departments that are working on this type of propulsion, I think the better, because we're clearly ready for it.
Yeah, and there are more companies working on it. In fact, one specific company I looked at was called General Atomics Electromagnetic Systems.
Wait, General Atomics?
General Atomics.
Oh, isn't that from, like, Fallout franchise?
This all sounds fake.
I thought it was from Jetsons.
That's Spacely Sprockets, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In September, they announced their own design of a microreactor using HALEU fuel. It's different. It's a pump. They pump a liquid propellant, so it's a different system,
right,
in which they're dealing with the fuel. But the point is that yes, multiple companies seem to all be working on this as part of their slate of nuclear developments, whether it's for terrestrial use or for space use, but it is definitely within multiple companies looking at this.
Yeah, I like the idea of developing it simultaneously as a commercial source of power as well as a propulsion for an interplanetary spaceship.
Definitely.
Oh, absolutely.
Cool. All right. Thanks, Evan.
Thanks.
Jay, it is Who's That Noisy Time?
All right, guys. Last week, I played this noisy. So what is that?
Sounds like a critter.
Yeah, but I don't know.
But everything he plays sounds like a critter. Yeah.
Right, but they're only critters part of the times. It's a computer or something sounding like a critter.
We got a Who's That Noisy Favorite. Visto Tutti wrote in and said, given your clue that it's something in the news recently, well, there was only one news item, so I say it is a sonification of the U.S. election voting patterns, a drone of two tones constant, and I guess the clicking sounds are cities. That is a fun but incorrect guess. And I wonder if the I was thinking of if the the ballot boxes that when you slide your ballot in, that thing that feeds the you feed the paper into, I wonder if they make any paper noises or anything interesting. I never heard any of that, but that is not correct. Another listener named iPuppy wrote in and said, Jay, you gave a lot of clues, so I know this is going to be a hard one. And I have no hope of getting it right, but here goes. This is the sound made by one of the high-energy colliders that are making such great discoveries these days as it starts up. The short sounds early on are some sort of initiator, while the repetitive oscillating sounds in the machine generating whatever it does. Can't wait to find out what it actually is. Stay safe, and yay science. That is not correct either. And here's the last guess. Alex Nelson. Hi, Jay. First-time guesser, longest-time listener. This week's noisy sounds to me like a machine, and your hints all but confirm this. It also sounds to me a bit like a larger copier rapidly churning out multiple pages. Between those observations and your hints, it seems obvious to me that it must be a ballot-counting machine. Very curious. Thanks so much for what you guys do. So I did get a lot of guesses of it being a ballot machine, but it isn't that. It's something that nobody thought of. This is actually music or sounds that are from a mushroom.
What?
Yes.
What does that even mean?
What?
I'll tell you. So mushrooms create an electric current.
It's the mycelium network.
Right. It is.
Oh, that's cool.
It is. So
band name.
They hooked up electrodes to a bunch of mushrooms, and they oddly produce this electrical current, which they they sonified. Is that the right way to put it?
They probably transduced it into sound.
Yeah. But I mean,
transduction is the right technical term.
It's representative of the flowing current that is happening in them. So let's listen to that again real quick. And I'd like to know why it's oscillating. What's happening?
Yeah, most things do.
Yeah. I'm wondering though, is the dual tonality of it, that high and the low, the chirping and then the kind of broader woo-woo, is that actually insects in the background, or are those both mushroom sounds?
Yeah, I think it is all mushroom sounds because the...
Oh, that's cool.
The picture that I saw, they were in a glass enclosure.
So they're not recording them in nature.
No.
Neat.
And at first I thought that was water dripping, and then I don't think so. I don't think that would be added to it. Because if you think about it, they're getting an electrical current from them. You don't need room noise. You just need to read the current.
Yeah.
So that's all their noise. They're clicking, they're talking, whatever they're doing. It's
cool.
So I just thought it was very interesting, particularly because mushrooms have been in the news lately because of the research that they're doing on them to fight depression. I know that Steve knows about that because we chatted about it briefly.
Oh, you're talking about psilocybin, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, not just
psilocybin.
Porcini mushrooms or something. Is that a thing? You're not talking about portobellos.
No. you don't eat. Yeah, it's thank God you don't eat psychedelics.
Well, you do eat them. They're disgusting. But,
yeah,
but you don't eat them for dinner.
Not like a gigantic. Forget about it. All right, I have a new noisy. Again, I think this one might be hard, but this one was so cool. I just have to play it for you, and we get to talk about it next week. So take a listen. Okay, so you hear two different sounds happen one after the other, right? So the first one lasts about 5 or 6 seconds, and then the second one happens, it sounds higher pitched, and that's about 5 or 6 seconds as well. They are two instances of the same thing happening that just happen to sound different. So you got to identify what is going on in that sound, what's happening. Something is taking place, and I'm trying to gauge it, you know, like it's my job to like drop some hints when I think you might need it. Go with your gut. That's going to be my hint. You know, whatever your first impression is, like whatever that reminds you of, go with it. You can email me with your guesses and cool sounds from this week at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thanks, Jay. So a couple of things to chat about really quickly, reminding everybody that January 23rd, Saturday from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Time is the SGU live 12-hour streaming event. Now, we're still in the middle of a pandemic, so we're not exactly sure how we're going to organize this. It will be some combination of people together in a live studio situation with other people streaming over the interwebs. And there will be audience participation and quizzes and interviews and all kinds of fun stuff. But we're still working on the details. But we've already written quite a bit of it, and it's going to be good. I'm getting excited about it. But still send us your ideas if you have any killer ideas for things you'd like to see us do during the 12-hour show. This is all to thank our patrons and all of our listeners and supporters and members. But we did hit our Patreon goal of 4,000 people. So thank you guys very much. We appreciate your support. Obviously, we would love for everyone to consider becoming a patron of the SGU. The more support we get, the more we can do, support skepticism and all that. So please consider, you know, taking a look. You get ad-free posts, you know, when we have ads. And we have as much premium content as we can get up there. We're talking about ways to sort of increase and expand the kind of premium content that we're putting up. We're going to take the live streams that we do. And, you know, we've done every Friday we do a live stream. And we get about 1,000 people showing up to those. They're a lot of fun. But we're going to take the audio from those and publish that basically as an audio standalone podcast for our patrons at any level. So we're at $5 or more level patron. You'll get access to the audio of the live streams. So we definitely want to keep figuring out ways of giving you guys more premium content for supporting the SGU. And Jay.
Yes.
So we got the end of the year episode coming up.
That's right.
Sort of the SGU review. What are we going to do this year?
Well, I was talking to Ian today, and I came up with the idea that instead of asking our listeners to send us the list of things that we ask, right, like your favorite episode, your favorite bit that we did, you know, there's like, you know, 10 or so questions that we ask every year, and people email us in, and then we try to like take all those emails and figure it all out and everything. What I'm going to do is I'm going to have Ian make a Google form, which is basically like a data entry form that you can go to. We'll give you the link hopefully next week. We'll have it all done. And then you could just go in and answer all the questions in there, and it'll make it very easy on us to read them and sort them and do what we got to do on our end.
All right. We'll keep you updated on all that stuff. One quick email before we go on to science or fiction. So we actually got a bunch of email about this. This is a follow-up to the piece I talked about last week about the magic amulets preventing COVID, and that, you know, horrible paper that was published in a peer-reviewed journal. At one point, as kind of an offhand comment, I said it was a throwaway journal, and several people objected to that characterization. So I just wanted to clarify what I was talking about. That probably did come off more harsh than I intended. So the term throwaway journal is a reference to journals, scientific journals, that are not the top tier journals that you would keep on your bookshelf, right? So there are some journals back in the day when they used to actually physically mail you a paper journal. I know that they still do that, but I mean, when that was all we had, like there was no internet where you could look up all the articles, you would get paper journals. And there were some journals that you would put on your shelf and you would keep it as a reference, right? And then there were other journals that you would read any articles that you thought were interesting, and then you would throw it away because you didn't have the shelf space to store every single journal that might come come across your desk. So those were considered throwaway journals, right? It doesn't mean that they're bad or that they're predatory or that they're crappy journals, just that they're not the top tier journals you're going to put on your bookshelf. So that's all I meant.
It's not science or nature.
Yeah, it's not science, nature, or field. Yeah, like or neurology, like for a neurologist. Yeah, exactly.
Or American psychologist. Yeah, like the top ones.
New England Journal of Medicine. It's not one of those that's like a keeper. So it was actually much milder, and it wasn't really even criticism. It was just saying that, yeah, this is just not one of the top tier journals. And from what I looked this up since, but multiple people pointed out, like they're familiar with that journal because it's in their field. It's actually a respected journal with a reasonable impact factor. It's like 6 point something, which is fine. That is a reasonable. And again, it's not Cell or Science or Nature, but it's fine. But actually, that just the more prestigious the journal is, the worse it is. You know that they published this horrible study.
Oh,
this
gosh. Horrible.
And the other
remember
update,
the Lancet? Oh my
god! Oh yeah, like the Lancet publishing.
Oh yeah, remember the I love it. Like rest in peace, Lancet.
It's the example.
So, sadly, but speaking of which, Evan, so the journal, the Science of the Total Environment, that originally published this study, you know, on magic amulets and COVID, they have temporarily removed the article. So they didn't retract it, but what they said was the publisher regrets that this article has been temporarily removed. A replacement will appear as soon as possible in which the reason for the removal of the article will be specified or the article will be reinstated. So basically they took it down while they're deciding whether or not to retract it, which they absolutely should because, you know, this article is an abomination.
Oof.
Yeah.
I actually, in the comments to my blog, a reader by the commenter by the name of Jonathan Jerry had actually interviewed the author, Dr. Bility, and wrote his own blog post about it, which he linked to. And I just wanted to read one little excerpt from that because he gives a quickish summary of what his actual theory is, which is a little bit more detailed than I gave last time. So here he goes. He writes, Bility suggests that when the magnetic field of our planet weakens, the amount of water that is found on land masses like lakes increases, and this leads to more iron oxide being made in certain rocks. These iron oxides have their own magnetic field, which now interacts with the iron in our bodies more readily. This interaction affects a property of the electrons in our atoms, and this can allegedly cause DNA sequences in our own genomes to turn into fully functional viruses that make us sick. That's basically his theory, and that the COVID-19 is one of these viruses, along with Zika and Ebola and other ones, that they're made from our own DNA based upon magnetic fields interacting with the electrons in our atoms. So complete and utter hogwash, in other words.
And the amulet restores balance? Is that the point?
Well, I guess it protects you from these malignant magnetic fields or whatever.
Oh, okay.
So there you go. If you felt like you needed more detail about what the hell that guy was talking about, that's as good a summary as any, I guess. Okay, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Just got 3 regular news items today. You guys ready?
Yep.
Yep.
Everyone's ready? Mm-hmm. Okay, here we go. Item number 1, astronomers find that the mean thermal energy density of gases in the universe has been increasing and is now 2 million Kelvin, 10 times hotter than 10 billion years ago. Item number 2, a new study finds that programs which demolish abandoned properties reduces nearby crime rates. And item number 3, a paleontology student has discovered that a fossil collection of ancient sharks in 2 UK museums are actually pterosaurs, including a previously unknown species. Okay, Jay, go first.
So the first one here, astronomers find that the mean thermal energy. Now, why has it got to be mean, Steve? What's with
median
the attitude?
Median mode, it's an average. Oh, gotcha.
Oh, I'm sorry. The density of gases in the universe has been increasing and is now 2 million Kelvin, 10 times hotter than 10 billion years ago. So why would it be getting hotter? Is it that all of that matter is being largely burned in stars and that therefore it's being converted to heat energy? Maybe. I don't know. This could be a lot of different things. But that's my best guess. So at least there is some type of answer in my head. The second one, a new study finds that programs which demolish abandoned properties reduce nearby crime rates. So there, you know, so less abandoned housing and buildings lowers crime. That seems to make a lot of sense. Less places to hide and, you know, to do your criminal behavior. But, you know, let me flip that around. What if the exact opposite is correct? If there's less housing, there's more crime. I don't know. That doesn't make sense. And the last one here, a paleontology student has discovered that a fossil collection of ancient sharks in two UK museums are actually, God damn it.
Pterosaurs.
Pterosaurs. like a pterodactyl. Yes, I got it. I know. It was way in the back of my brain.
He's like, Parasaurolophus. Parasaurolophus.
Patero.
Jay, as your son calls them, pterodactyls.
Yeah.
Oh, with the fizzle cyst.
The fizzle cyst, yeah.
Well, that is going to, I'll be thinking about that the day I die. It's so goddamn cute.
Yeah, that's the best.
You know, in this segment, when something happens and you're like, I want that to be true. I really want that story to be true. I love it when when young students figure something out that's meaningful. It's a lot of fun. All right. So to pick the one that's the fake, the likelihood of me knowing anything about the heat of the universe is very low. But I really do think that might be it. But we're saying it's a lot of heat. It's a lot more heat. That's a lot. Damn, Steve, these are very difficult. I'm going to put my nickel down that I am wrong, that the first one about the heat increasing, I know so little, I have to just bow down to my ignorance and say I'm wrong.
And therefore, that one?
that's the fiction.
Okay. All right, Kara?
This is a really tough one because they're all super random. Is the universe getting hotter? I don't know. Is it getting colder? I don't know. I think it's expanding. Maybe that would make it hotter. Although you might think it was getting cooler because of that, because there's more space in between the stuff, but the gases are now coalescing. I don't know. The demolishing abandoned properties, this one is killing me because there's so many unknowns here, right? Like, which cities is this taking place in? Were those abandoned properties condemned? Were they public housing? Is the crime rate like inflated because of racist policing? Like, there's so many things that are killing me about this one. It may end up having to be my fiction only because it's so vague. And I like literally was going to say the same words as Jay. I want the paleontology student one to be true. There's something so fun. I mean, it blows my mind that a shark could maybe, you know, something that people thought for so long could be was a shark, could be a pterosaur. But also, we've all spent time in the collections at museums. You remember when we went to multiple museums, even together.
Oh, yes.
And if you don't have a complete specimen, if something was a type specimen or it was so old and it was cataloged and it went into a drawer and started to collect dust, I think there's probably a lot of mistakes, like ancient mistakes in museum collections. And the idea that maybe the student said, for my thesis, I'm going to go through old drawers, makes me very happy. So I think I'm going to put my nickel down on the demolished abandoned properties one and say that that's the fiction, because it really could go a lot of different ways based on more information.
Okay, Bob.
All right, well, I can make sense of the first one, the mean thermal energy density. Well, yeah, okay. I mean, Jay actually had a reasonable idea of it's a more of the gas is being used up. I mean, there's a finite amount of gas in the observable universe, and eventually it's going to be all gone. So more and more of it's being used up, and collected around groups of galaxies, superclusters, and stuff. So I can make sense of that. The abandoned property one, I mean, superficially it makes a lot of sense. You're removing areas where crimes can occur, and you know, it's a lot easier to commit a crime in one of the many rooms of an abandoned building than just a piece of property that's been leveled. But then of course Kara's making me second guess myself on that one. And the fossil collection, I mean, I'm familiar with pterosaur skeletons. I mean, I can't imagine making that mistake. And if these are unknown species, at least some of them, perhaps they somehow could look more shark-like. I mean, some of them had some pretty nasty-looking teeth. So that one kind of makes sense, too. And I think I'm just going to do a GWC, go with Kara against my gut on this one. And because going with my gut's not very useful this year anyway, so what the hell. All right, two. Okay, I'll go with Kara. Crime,
okay.
Fiction.
And Evan?
I think I'll go with Kara as well. I think maybe with this one, it's the fact that instead of reducing the crime rate maybe stays the same and just disperses it in a different pattern almost. So I think it's something along those lines.
Okay. So you all agree with the third one, so we'll start there. A paleontology student has discovered that a fossil collection of ancient sharks in two UK museums are actually pterosaurs, including a previously unknown species. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Oh my God, yay!
Wow. Awesome.
So Kara's right, a lot of research happens in dusty drawers. There's just so many fossils in there that just were only superficially looked at or even never looked at. And, you know, you don't have to go out into the field and find bones. You can just go into the museum drawers and find them and do research on them. So this wasn't this is a PhD student, Roy Smith, at the University of Portsmouth, looking at a collection, not just one fossil, but a collection of fossils that were labeled as shark fossils in the Sedgwick Museum of Cambridge and the Booth Museum at Brighton. Now, interestingly, Bob, you said that the pterosaurs might have teeth. These are actually toothless pterosaurs. And what they mistook, they thought that the jawbone of these pterosaurs was the shark fin spines because they do look very similar. But there are lots of small differences that were missed by the original paleontologists who classified them. Like, for example, the pterosaur jawbones have tiny holes for nerve endings for sensitivity would not be present in the shark fin spines. Apparently they are superficially similar. So yeah, they completely got the wrong order, not even close. Okay, let's go backwards. We'll go back to number two. A new study finds that programs which demolish abandoned properties reduces nearby crime rates. Bob, Evan, and Kara, you think this one is a fiction. Jay, you think this one is science. So, Kara, what if I told you? I was going to give you this information, but you didn't give me a chance. Mm. But I'll give you the extra details.
Okay.
Too late now. That,
so, this is in Kansas City, if you want to know where it was, in Kansas City.
Kansas City.
And This was dilapidated, abandoned residential properties.
Dilapidated, abandoned residential properties. I don't think that changes my mind.
So, these were mainly homes that were abandoned because of the foreclosure crisis of 2007 and 2008. And the idea behind the study was previous studies would show that there's a correlation between the density of these abandoned properties and crime rates. So they said, okay, let's tear them down, see what happens. So this
but that leaves out, all the confounding factors of poverty and So I don't know. That still doesn't convince me.
Yeah, good. This one is the fiction. This one's the fiction. Because nice. It had no effect. Everyone's correct. It had zero effect. I won't say zero effect. It had no significant effect on the crime rate. But what the crime rate did track with was other factors like socioeconomic status, how well employed the population was, things like that. So, but this is based upon prior studies which showed a correlation. But, yeah, it seems likely that the correlation was due to a third or other factors and wasn't directly causative. A poor economy would cause both more crime and more abandoned residential properties, right?
Well, and it takes me back to, The Wire, where, this informs policing. And, unfortunately, I think that you see that police officers go to places like this expecting crime, and then they find crime, and then they arrest low-income people in places like this, instead of going into other places where there is also crime, but it's a different, quote, clientele, or a different, type of person as they see it committing the crime. Yeah. And so I think that, this kind of view, this is an important study because it flies in the face of some of these pre-existing notions that people have or motivated reasoning or whatever.
Yeah, you can't just remove the superficial factor.
Exactly.
Going to affect the underlying problem. It was kind of like the broken window hypothesis too, which turned out not to be true. It's like, in crappy looking neighborhoods, there's more crime. So let's, clean up the windows and then there'll be less crime. It's like, nope, you've got the wrong cause and effect. So it's not really going to do anything. So basically what the researchers think is happening here is that the criminals aren't going away because you tore down the house they were sitting in.
They have less opportunity.
They're just going to, they're still going to commit crimes. They're just not going to be in that abandoned house, you know. You haven't changed their life situation. You haven't given them a job or fixed the economy or whatever.
Right. If somebody needs to use, they're going to find another place to use. If somebody needs to steal, or they feel, I shouldn't say needs, but feel motivated to steal because they need the money, they're just going to find another way to go about it. Of course.
So it wasn't, it was just, it just showed, it's very important because it just shows that's not the cause of the problem. It was just one of the markers. And therefore, fixing it, that didn't do anything. All right. All this means that astronomers find that the mean thermal energy density of gases in the universe has been increasing and is now 2 million Kelvin, 10 times hotter than 10 billion years ago, is science.
I have no idea what this is. I don't either. About.
Like,
zero.
What?
All right.
Why? How?
We have touched upon this previously. Bob will probably remember the idea that gases, like interstellar gases and even intergalactic gases, are super hot. They're like millions of
crazy
degrees.
Hot.
And it seems counterintuitive. How can deep space be 2 million degrees? Well, it's like, okay, yes, the gas technically is that hot, but it's so dispersed that you wouldn't feel it, right? Very little energy would be transferred to you. You would still be, you know, near absolute zero is what you would experience. But the individual, you know, hydrogen atoms in the gas cloud may be vibrating at 2 million Kelvin. So Why has all this intergalactic gas been heating up? The universe, in a sense, is heating up. And they think that the reason is, Bob, that as galaxies form, they draw in dark matter and gases through gravity, right? And the process of doing that is actually very violent, and it causes tremendous heating. It heats up those gases. So the universe is heating up basically as gravity is coalescing, drawing in all of that dark matter and gas into galaxies and into galaxy clusters.
Are you putting the cart before the horse? I mean, didn't the dark matter kind of draw in all the other stuff first?
Well, whatever. But the dark matter is also being drawn in, they said. Dark matter, it wasn't. They said this is kind of, this supports Peebles. You remember Peebles? He won the Nobel Prize in 2019, Jim Peebles, for the large-scale structure of the universe, you know, his theory for the large-scale structure of the universe. So this kind of supports his theories and is in line with that, that how the large-scale structures of the universe form, if you model that, it does fit with the notion that it is heating up all of the gas in the universe. Because, it's not like the dark matter today has the same structure it did 10 billion years ago. Because again, dark matter not only it has gravity, but it also is affected by gravity.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, the reason I say that, I mean, coincidentally, I'm listening to The End of Everything by Katie Mack, which is a great, great book, and she's talking about dark matter and how it doesn't interact with light, which means that it could coalesce more easily than regular matter because there's no real pressure that's being created in the dark matter because it's immune to light.
So it might have happened first, but it still happened, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah, but it's weird to think that like in the space is 2 million Kelvin.
Yeah, right.
And by the way, just a little nerdy aside point, which I learned at some point in doing this podcast from other people, is that Kelvin is the only temperature scale where you can actually say that like a million degrees is 10 times hotter than 100,000 degrees.
Right.
It's actually not even degrees, it's not accurate. So like a million Kelvin is 10 times hotter than 100,000 Kelvin. That you can't say that for any other temperature scale because it's not an absolute scale, but Kelvin is an absolute scale.
Yeah.
Mm, yeah.
Absolutely.
All right, Evan, it's quote time. Give us a quote.
Yeah. This one was suggested by a listener, David from Iowa. And I was going to look for an Alex Trebek quote myself, but he kind of beat me to it. And I thought this was a very good one. So I'm just going to go with what David suggested. So thanks, David. I appreciate this. There's a certain comfort that comes from knowing a fact. The sun is up in the sky. There's nothing you can say that's going to change that. You can't say, the sun's not up there, there's no sky. There is reality, and there's nothing wrong with accepting reality. It's when you try to distort reality, to maneuver it into accommodating your particular point of view, your particular bigotry, your particular whatever, that's when you run into problems. Alex Trebek. We lost him. Lost him.
I know.
Recently, yeah.
Yeah, he died recently. Oh. Interestingly, very close to Sean Connery, who also died.
I know, yes.
Because I forever associate Alex Trebek and Sean Connery in my mind.
Oh, because
now.
Of SNL?
Because of that SNL skit. It's amazing, you know. I'll take swords for 400.
Exactly. There's your Sean Connery quote.
Did you guys know that I was lucky enough to be on Jeopardy?
Yes.
No way.
Yes.
I did. I forgot.
I remember that a couple years
ago. Yeah. So I was lucky enough to read clues for two different categories. So I taped it all in the same day, but it aired across two episodes. And my interaction with Alex was minimal. I mean, I mostly spent time with his producers in preparation and during the recording. Obviously, me reading clues meant he was not having to be on camera at that moment. But I sat in his dressing room for the makeup touch-ups, and he popped his head in to say hello, and he was just so gracious and so kind. And, you know,
really?
The 2 seconds that I got to spend in his presence is nothing compared to the people who spent their lives close to him. But he was
classy.
He was so classy. He was a total skeptic. He was brilliant and really, I think, respected and honored science, reason, knowledge. I mean, that quote, Evan, like, it was an amazing quote.
How great
and
is
I think
that?
Yeah. Jeopardy inspired so many people to want to know things.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other game show hosts who are respected? Like,
not
in their
that
role
way.
As
not
a
in
game
the,
show host?
Not in the U.S. in that way, yeah. I don't think. Or at least not anymore.
Snoop Dogg?
Bob Barker, maybe? I don't
no,
know.
Cool. Bob Barker.
Maybe. Monty
yeah, Bob
Hall.
Barker. Yeah.
I mean, they were good.
Beloved.
Yeah.
He was beloved, yeah.
ASPC, or the SPCA or whatever. Yeah, that was a big part.
Yeah,
But
I think
Alex
is in a category of his own. I agree.
Yeah. Class All right. act.
And if you like that show, if you like Jeopardy, Alex filmed 35 episodes that are airing now, and he was filming up to 2 weeks before he died. So there's more new Alex to come before
he
will
right
live forever
end.
In reruns.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
All right, so guys, we have our Friday stream coming up this week, which I'll be at. But the next week's Friday stream, so this is the one after the show comes out.
Yeah, so the one airing on Friday the 20th of November.
Yes, I will not be on that one with you guys. Okay. So,
You're going to give us control without being there.
Hey, what can I'm going to be working. I'm going to be in the hospital from 5 to 10 that day, so... Can't do it, Levy.
Can you turn on your camera and put like a dummy like Bob did? No.
In my office?
Yeah.
Sure.
Great.
Do that. Well, I mean, Ian's going to need control. I assume he'll have control.
Yeah, Ian will have control of my computer.
Oh, boy.
Uh-oh.
All right. Are you laying down any rules, Steve, or what?
It's chaos.
I've missed one before. This won't be the first time. And then after that is the Friday after Thanksgiving. We have to think about what we're going to do that Friday.
Right.
We'll think about it. We'll let you know next week.
Okay. Wow.
But we might take a break for some of the holiday days coming up. Like Christmas Day, I don't think it's going to happen.
That is a Friday.
Yeah, that is a Friday. Well, with Christmas coming in. Oh, no. All right, guys. Good night, brother.
Deeply programmed.
See you on the live stream. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.